to Native America Calling. From Studio 869 in Isleta Pueblo, I'm Tara Gatewood. For some, when forests disappear, water is polluted, homelands flood, and animals and plants disappear, it can feel like the death of a loved one. For indigenous people whose culture and identity are closely tied to the land and animals, environmental changes can also feel like a piece of a person's identity is missing. The response is often expressed as grief or collective mourning of the land. Join us after the news this Earth Day as we focus on what it takes to...
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Within days of Montana's first confirmed COVID-19 case, Blackfeet Nation declared a state of emergency and closed down. Now it's leading the way in vaccinations. In part two of this two-part story, Yellowstone Public Radio's Caitlin Nicholas reports on how the tribe was successful quickly in its vaccination effort.
A 95% vaccination rate is much higher than the rest of the country. Several factors made this possible. Vaccines are coming to Blackfeet Nation from two sources. Blackfeet's Tribal Health Department receives allotments through Montana's Health Department, while the two Indian Health Service units on the reservation receive another allocation from the federal government. But Brittany Racine, a registered nurse at the Tribal Health Improvement Program, says education played an important role, as well as the fact that everyone in Blackfeet Nation was personally impacted by COVID-19.
We're such a small community, and so when we would have a death, we were all really impacted by it. That had a lot to do with people wanting to get vaccinated so they wouldn't lose a family member or they wouldn't put people at risk.
Since March 15th, 2020, Blackfeet Nation has lost 48 tribal members to COVID-19. Rayola Grant is the nursing instructor at Blackfeet Community College. On a windy day in the Blackfeet Tribal Health Department's RV mobile clinic, she's supervising nursing students distributing vaccines. Grant says the vaccine rollout order was also important. Frontline workers in healthcare, grocery stores, and other high-contact jobs were vaccinated first, followed by elders.
I think that was really encouraging for people who didn't want to, because the elders got it first. We also look to them for our guidance. They got it, so that guided the younger generation to have a little more trust, a little more willingness, even though they were very scared.
Grant says many were worried about the side effects of the vaccine, which can include fevers, nausea, and body aches. She says elders also needed to confront traumatic past experiences to get the vaccine. Historical documents show that during the 1960s and 70s, the U.S. government repeatedly abused Native Americans in health care. In one instance, doing medical testing without consent on Native children in boarding schools, and in another, sterilizing Native women suffering from mental illness. Grant says providing education to elders about COVID vaccines has helped alleviate some mistrust of the federal government.
But it's also coming from their people, you know, from people who look like them. We're so community-oriented, and so I think the elders really had to step up and show the younger people, we did it, get in line!
Since vaccines have been so widely distributed, Grant says their effectiveness has been, quote, proven to the tight-knit community.
It's real, you know, we haven't had a funeral for COVID lately since the vaccines.
In Montana, for National Native News, I'm Caitlin Nicholas.
The First Lady of the U.S., Jill Biden, will be welcomed on Navajo land Thursday. President Jonathan Nez, during a virtual town hall, talked about plans, which include meeting with Navajo women leaders, educators, and touring a COVID-19 vaccination clinic on Friday.
She'll be visiting here on Navajo, a school, at the Tseotsoy Medical Center. She wants to know how you all did, Navajo people, on keeping these numbers low.
The events are closed to the public, but will be live streamed. The new series, Rutherford Falls, showcasing Native talent both on screen and behind the camera, premieres Thursday on Peacock.
I am the steward of my family's legacy that will resonate throughout history.
And you have a museum.
You're going to get yours too.
The comedy is about two friends who find themselves at a crossroad. The Native representation includes five writers and stars, Janice Schmieding and Michael Gray Eyes. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
This reminder to get your COVID-19 vaccination is provided by the Association of American Indian Physicians and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, who support this show. Info at aaip.org or cdc.gov/coronavirus.
Support by Ramona Farms, offering wholesome and delicious foods from our heirloom crops as our contribution to a better diet for the benefit of all people. We are honored to share our centuries-old farming and culinary traditions online at ramonafarms.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood, joining you live from my homelands of Shirwiktui. Indigenous people are traditionally very closely associated with the land, so when we see contamination or long-lasting destruction, it can translate to feelings of loss, even grief. Some Indigenous communities are seeing rapid and significant change, like the loss of sea ice from climate shift. And such grief affects people's well-being and sense of identity. Addressing that grief is a matter of recognizing the problem and providing effective support. Our guest today will talk about how this grief relates to sovereignty, cultural preservation, and traditional food revitalization. And we want to hear from you. Is environmental grief a phrase you've encountered before? And how do environmental changes affect you emotionally? You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And today we're going to start off in Toronto, Canada. With us on the line is Dr. Deborah McGregor, and she is an associate professor at York University, and she is Anishinaabe from the White Fish River First Nation. Our pleasure to have her here today. Dr. McGregor, welcome to Native America Calling, and I understand you simply go by Deborah. So Deborah, thank you for being with us, and welcome.
Wonderful to be here. Thank you.
And so, Deborah, let's talk a little bit. Ecological grief. What does that mean to you, and what do you think is critical for listeners to understand about this concept?
I guess there's a couple things that I would say is that Indigenous peoples have experienced to some extent ecological grief before, particularly with colonization. And I'll speak specifically to North America or Turtle Island, because we did experience massive environmental destruction and change as part of the forces of colonization. We just didn't have a name for it, the loss of what we experienced, particularly maybe being removed from our homeland. So there definitely is other ideas around intergenerational trauma, because the earth itself and the land itself can also experience trauma. So this is part of how we understand our relationships. But I think what's happened in recent times, and what I mean in recent times is the last few decades, is it's intensified because of the broader public consciousness around ecological or major climate change that's basically changing the face of the planet. This is what all the science says. We're bombarded with this. So now it's part of the public consciousness. Broader, beyond Indigenous communities are starting to understand and experience this. But it's in my view, it's been there. We just didn't name it in that way. Although I think people have felt it. I think the other thing I would say about that, as devastating as it is, we have, as Indigenous people, figured out ways to cope and move through that, which is, you know, why we're here today and being able to engage in this conversation, that that we have been able to move through huge loss and grief in our lives for various reasons, particularly to the land. So that's just sort of like my initial thinking at the moment. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate that. And when we talk about relationship with the land, that's a lot of stuff. For you, what does that mean, this relationship?
It means that we're part of the land itself. So we, I'll speak specifically to the Anishinaabe tradition because you have other guests and they'll speak from their perspective, is that we actually understand the earth as being alive, having spirit, having its own agency. So it's not like this binary that I think broader society tends to have in terms of how they understand their relationship to the natural world. There's a separation. For us, it's not like that. Like, literally, it's part of us. So when the earth is experiencing trauma or a loss, which it does through species or, you know, whatever else might be happening around the world or to the planet, we actually literally experience that ourselves in our own bodies and in our own lives. So our relationship is very close. It's, you know, we don't have that kind of separation. So it's not like, okay, we're worried about what's happening to the environment. We are, but to us, it's actually part of who we are. So we kind of talk about it in different ways. So when we're part of it, whatever happens to us happens to the land. So our mourning and grief over our own ancestors is also the earth also grieving itself. So the earth itself would be grieving as well, because it's part of who we are, because it's also experiencing loss, even if the loss is, you know, so much of our ancestors during the, you know, pandemics and disease that hit our communities as part of our history. Well, and I just listened to the show just before, or the news before this show started, and you know, it's still an issue, and that trauma is still there. So I think we just have this history that's so distinct in terms of colonization, but also in terms of our thousands of years understanding and relationship to the land and the natural world itself.
And how does this compare to what we hear and understand beyond our native nations, understanding this relationship, understanding ecological grief, anything there? Deborah?
I think that one of the major differences that I feel, and there's definitely commonalities, which is good, because it means you can work collaboratively together and ideally seek solutions, is, again, it's I find particularly in the Western worldview and scientific point of view, is that the earth is seen as being separate. The earth isn't really seen as being alive and having personality and having its own agency. I don't know if I've seen where there's been recognition that the earth itself is also grieving, is also experiencing a loss, and is also mourning. So to me, that would be one of the major differences that I've seen. And that's not to invalidate like the broader work that's happening around this. To me, it's critically important, and there's way more overlap and commonalities that you know, we can draw from. But to me, there are some distinctions like that, and the core of it is how we actually understand the land and the earth itself.
Well, thank you for that.
Somehow helpful, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Deborah McGregor is here with us. Any thoughts for her? Give us a ring. 1-800-996-2848 is the number to join us. And what do you think? Loss of land, destruction of land leading to grief? Is this something you've experienced? What does it lead you to do? Today is Earth Day. Many people are thinking about the ground we stand on and our ecological system. How is it? Is it out of whack? And how does that affect you personally, emotionally? Give us a ring. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. Also here too, out of Anchorage, Alaska, is Vi Waihi, and she is as a Sivukuk Yupik grandmother. She is a native village of Savunga tribal citizen. She's also the Environmental Health and Justice Program Director for Alaska Community Action on Toxics. And she's also a member of the White House Environmental Justice Advisory Council. Vi, thank you for joining us today here on Native America Calling. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Pangunak. I'm the daughter of the late John and Delawari. I am from Sivukuk, our traditional name for St. Lawrence Island. My apa is a Bungurumi and Gangirumi clan. My grandmother is a Walit. I am, as you mentioned, a Sivuk Akhubik grandmother, and I am calling in from Anchorage, Alaska. I would like to acknowledge which are the traditional lands of the Dena Aina people, unceded territory. I am from Sivuk, located on Sivuk. I live and work here in Anchorage. We own our island, which is located in the northern Bering Sea.
Well, Vi, I appreciate you joining us today and just your thoughts. Ecological grief. Go ahead.
Yes. You know, I when I received a call from the associate producer, I jumped on it and rearranged my schedule so I can speak on this topic, which we never hear too much about. And it's great to hear the work that Deborah has done. And I look forward to hearing from Dune, who I've worked with before. As the previous speaker mentioned, you know, it is our identity as Sivuk Akhupik people to live off the land and ocean like we have since time immemorial. And we used to have 20,000 of us in 32 communities on Sivuk. Sivuk is about the same size as Puerto Rico, which has approximately 3 million people. So a pretty big island in the northern Bering Sea where we can actually see Russia from our window. We're closer to Siberia than mainland Alaska. And we now have two communities with approximately 1,700 people. And due to Western contact, we, our numbers of our Yupik people were drastically devastated by Western contact, whether it was the whalers, whether it was archaeology.
Sure, and their impact has been huge. And that leads right into what we're talking about today. Vi, I want you to open up even more right after the break. But if you'd like to join us, dial now, 1-800-996-2848. Spear fishing is a tradition among Ojibwe and other tribes, especially in the Great Lakes area. It's a subsistence activity, and tribes' rights to spear fish are affirmed in past treaties. We'll learn more about the practice and why it remains an important tradition. That's on the next Native America Calling.
If you're hurting in your relationship or have been affected by sexual violence, Strong Hearts Native Helpline is a no-charge, 24/7, confidential and anonymous domestic, dating, and sexual violence helpline for Native Americans. Help is available by calling 1-844-762-8483 or by clicking on the Chat Now icon on strongheartshelpline.org. This program is supported by the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center.
You're listening to Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood from Isleta Pueblo, and we're focusing on ecological grief, how the loss of land and natural resources can affect people emotionally and culturally. It's something that many of our discussions about climate shift allude to. And you're welcome to join the discussion today. We're at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And with us today on the line is Vi Waihi. And Vi, I would like you to continue where we left off right before the break, where you were explaining exactly who your people are and some of the journey they've come and how this applies to the world we're seeing today and the effects and things, how things have changed. Go ahead. Continue.
Yes. Thank you. As I was mentioning, you know, we've had loss of our people, loss of our communities, due to epidemics and starvation from Western contact. before all this Western contact, our people thrived, living as one with our lands and waters, taking only what we need. We were original stewards of our lands and waters. We believe the wildlife give themselves up so that we can continue as Sivukak Yupik people to continue our traditions and cultures. And most people in the lower 48 think that Alaska is the last frontier and pristine. At one time, it was just like that. As our people historically and present day today, we have the most respect for our lands and waters and wildlife. And now we're seeing loss associated with the two formerly used defense sites because of our proximity to Russia. The Air Force came and established two bases. We were an important strategic location. Our community of Gambel is about 40 miles away from Siberia. Our two FUD sites were the eyes and ears of the North during the Cold War. And we welcomed the military. And when we turned our lands and waters over, there was agreement signed by the military and our tribe in Savunga that basically stated that our lands would be turned back in the pristine condition when we turned them over to the military. And they have never gone along with that agreement, even though they signed it. They abandoned a pretty big installation. Northeast Cape used to be one of the most abundant fishing location on our island. At the Suki River, the fish have never returned. We have no more seal haulouts off the coast of Northeast Cape. We have no more tomcod fishing. Our families are now displaced because of the military toxics that the Air Force abandoned. The other base at the other end of our island, everything was buried. When they came, they brought everything they ever needed for 15 years and buried everything. Our community now on Gambel is on top of the waste site. The school, the playground, the municipal buildings. This has resulted in health disparities of our people. Environmental racism, environmental violence. It's been very difficult to hold the military accountable. This has resulted in a cancer crisis in our families who are now elders that played and swam at the Suki River, not knowing that there were toxic chemicals that include PCBs, pesticides, heavy metal solvents. And then the Arctic has become a hemispheric sink for persistent organic pollutants. We now know this because of our community-based participatory research project on our island with our leadership. And anytime a chemical is manufactured, anytime it is applied, spilled, used, it comes up here through air and ocean currents and get trapped here and has nowhere else to go because it's cold. We're finding this persistent organic. Go ahead.
And Vi, all of this I understand is very alarming, especially when you think of the people that were here before us, you know, our ancestors and everything that they did, the decisions they made so that we could be here. And then to hear some of these things going on and understanding the world that they were living in, where some of these crises were not taking place. And so by everything that you've explained, and there's a lot, and there's even more that you could explain of how much this is traumatizing community members, but all of this and what it is, how heavy does that weigh on you? How does it affect you as a person? And maybe even, you know, your thoughts for the future?
As I mentioned, you know, we have a cancer crisis. I'm a cancer survivor. We were a family of eight, my parents and my siblings, and half of us have gotten cancer. And we just lost two elders recently with health disparities we associate with the military toxics, but also the pops we're finding in our most sacred, our traditional foods. And so this is very, very devastating. It's alarming. These are so unethical, the practices that the military has done to not do adequate site characterization, remediation. And this is resulting in our people, loss of lives, our identity, and our being as indigenous people of the Arctic. And this has been going on for decades. It's going to be about 50 years since the military abandoned the two bases. And it's loss of lives, it's grief associated with the loss of our foods at Northeast Cape, the loss, and now we now know that there's persistent organic pollutants in the walrus seals that are ice dependent as marine mammals. Our elders call our ocean our farm. That is our main food during our long winters. And to learn that pops are in the blubber and rendered oil, which are important foods for my people, at Devils we should not be eating them for excess cancer risk. But most important, our people feel the benefits still outweigh the risk of these pops in our sacred foods that have sustained our people for millennia. And it is a grief that we live with daily, the health disparities, the knowing that the Hmong duck, our communities just harvested four bullhead whale past 3 days. Our communities are celebrating coming together for these bullhead whales to give themselves up so that we can continue as Siwokahupik people. And it is the way of life with the utmost respect for our lands and waters, and it's not something we can separate ourselves. So the devastation is in loss of lives, but also our pristine lands and waters we have lived sure. with as one.
And not being able to separate from all this. I think that is a really important part, too, and understanding why, you know, we see so many people speaking up from Indigenous nations about what happens to the land, is this tie can't be separated. It's you know, the belief of many people is this is where we come from, this is who we are, it's a part of us. Vi, I thank you for giving us your thoughts today. I got a caller on the line who'd like to add some words. So we're going to say hi to Johnny, who is in Rio Rancho, New Mexico, tuned in on KUNM. Johnny, thank you for giving us a ring. Go ahead. You're on air.
Okay, my name is Johnny Smith. I am military retiree. But my point I'd like to make, yes, there's a lot of devastating pollution and different stuff going on here within the United States, a country referred to as Turtle Island before the Europeans got here. Me, I am of Native American and Black ancestry. And my friends or people, however you want to put it, refer to ourselves as invisible people. But we see a lot of things that's going on in this country. And, you know, the pipelines, the fracking, drilling for oil. Even here in New Mexico, where I live at, not long ago, it was a gold mine, that had a few of them that had been closed off. And the water and contaminants within this gold mine were accidentally released and released into the Rio Grande River. And, you know, the government said, okay, we clean it up. It's okay to drink now. But that, we all know that's not true. We know it's not true for the simple fact that if it was okay to drink, then they wouldn't have considered themselves cleaning it up and bringing it down to acceptable levels. The way I see it, acceptable levels is putting something back the way it was, as it was before it was contaminated. And how do you clean up a river that have fish in it that people eat and various other types of just animals, creatures. The deer drank from the river. The elks drank from the river. The fish are in the river. And people eat these deer, these elk, and these fish. And it's going to be years. Right now, I am in my 60s. And, you know, I enjoy living here in Rio Rancho, and I enjoy being a part of the community here. I actually, from time to time, you know, I go to the various powwows we have here. Haven't had one recently because of COVID-19. But, you know, I see a lot of other people like myself who are of mixed nationality. But, you know, it doesn't make a difference whether you're mixed nationality or whether you're 100% Native. The point is we all have to live here. We don't have another place we can go. We've got one earth. And without the ability to pick up, leave here, and go to another planet, you know, I just hope when we get to that planet, we don't pollute it also.
All right. Johnny, thank you for your call. Thank you for your words. Thank you for your service. And Johnny, I think something too, that you mentioned of how long it takes to clean things up and the type of stress that brings emotionally, or being able to connect to a certain place. And when there is devastation, that means not being able to go and take from the river like you have done traditionally. It also means places that have been contaminated, you can't go there to get resources, maybe even finding different type of things that traditionally you're called upon to do throughout the season. And when all of these things kind of happen, how does that affect you personally? You can share some thoughts with us today. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. Again, Johnny, thank you for your call. Also here, too, out of Cordova, Alaska, is Dune Lankard, and he is the president of the Native Conservancy, and he is Iak Athabaskan. Our pleasure to have him here with us today. Dune, welcome to Native America Calling.
Hi, thank you very much.
And Dune, lots of good words being said here today. Anything you want to start with?
Sure. I'd like to say hello to Vi, and I'm always honored to hear her words and her voice, and it makes me sad to hear what's happening, still continuing to happen to her people. You know, it's tough. Because we want things to, you know, improve and be better, and they're not. And here in my region, we had three major catastrophes in the Prince William Sound. In 1964, we had the Good Friday earthquake that rocked our world and disrupted our fisheries, disrupted our way of life. And 25 years later, on Good Friday again, to the date of the 64 quake, we had the 1989 Exxon Valdez oil spill happen in our backyard. And it rocked our world again, our fisheries. And it took 25 years for the crustaceans and the fish to find a way to come back. And thank God they're resilient. But now, 25 years later, we're dealing with climate change. And when I think about, you know, just how climate change is impacting us now, we're dealing with ocean acidification, the blob, which is the warming of the oceans, and ocean rise that's impacting villages across Alaska because they're going to have to move to higher ground. When, you know, I think about the last 3 years of fishing, usually we'd have 1 to 2 million sockeye salmon, red salmon, return to the Copper River Delta annually. 3 years ago, only 44,000 sockeyes found their way home. The following year, in 2019, we experienced 76-degree Fahrenheit temperatures in our oceans down to 20 feet below the surface. This ended up killing millions of krill, mussels, wild kelp forests, salmon, birds, impacting our subsistence and commercial fishing way of life almost beyond belief. And so when I think about the ecological grief that we've been witnessing in our lifetime, it's devastating because we're seeing, because Alaska was colder than most places, our glaciers, our permafrost and sea ice is melting at unprecedented rates. And when I, you know, think about, you know, how does this impact us culturally, physically, emotionally, in all the ways it leads to spiritual bankruptcy, because we can't trust anyone. We can't trust our government. We can't trust the military. We can't trust our government. You know, when the Gulf of Mexico spill happened, Obama went down there within a matter of days and was trying to figure out how to work with the people and the land and the cleanup and make sure that it was fair. We never had that luxury. No one came. There wasn't no, you know, disaster order declared. There wasn't, you know, the Alaska delegation didn't step in. The president of the United States didn't step in. Exxon came and said, you know, we're going to make you whole again. We're going to take care of you. We're Exxon. We do it right. Well, they appealed our $94.5 billion verdict 17 times until they got the Supremes of their dreams.
And you know what, Duke, we got to go to break here. I do want you to pick up after the break. But just hearing this and understanding, you know, this was one of the biggest news stories that people had their eye on. And to think about it now, your thoughts. Hang tight. More's ahead.
Support by Amerind, Indian Country's 100% tribally owned insurance partner. Amerind works with tribal governments and their business enterprises to provide effective commercial insurance coverage, strengthen Native American communities, protect tribal sovereignty, and help keep dollars in Indian Country. More information on property, liability, workers' compensation, and commercial auto solutions at Amerind.com. That's Amerind.com.
Thanks for tuning in to Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood, and we are talking about a term. It's called ecological grief, and it leads to feelings of, or it is a result of feelings of loss in response to land, significant environmental assets, as well as devastation to the land. And is this something you're familiar with? Maybe you don't use this term, but you've been talking about all this. You understand how things relate. We're ready for you to comment on all this by dialing in. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. And right before the break, we heard from Dune Lankard, president of the Native Conservancy. He is Eyak Athabascan. And I'm just going to turn it back to you, Dune. Please continue with your thought.
Sure. You know, when the spill, Exxon spill happened in our backyard, and Exxon appealed the decision 17 times over 20 years, over 6,000 of the original 30,000 plaintiffs died before ever seeing a settlement. And that means 20% died from natural causes before they seen any compensation for their lost way of life. And so when I think about why the Supremes took the case, they took it to set a precedent against communities experiencing man-made catastrophes. In our home, we're facing divorce, suicides, fishing cooperative breakups that were, you know, 15, 20 years long of different fishermen working together to, you know, try and offset their overhead and catch more fish, and where it was followed by alcohol abuse and drugs and the loss of our boats and permits, prices of salmon collapsed. And as I mentioned, no one came to help. Exxon would have had a better result if they would have taken their $2 billion cleanup and put all that money in $1 bills in a 747 and flew over the Prince William Sound and just opened up the gates and dropped all that money on top of this spill and hired people to go out and pick up the money. They would have done a better job cleaning up the oil spill than they had done on that $2 billion dog and pony show, where the first thing they did was use Corexit to sink the oil out of sight so cameras couldn't take the pictures of the actual devastation. And here we are 20 years later. We still haven't learned anything. Dispersants is still the number one response to oil spills. Get it out of the media. Get it out of the public eye as fast as possible. And so, you know, I feel like, you know, as an EAC person, you know, someone from the Eagle Clan, my EAC name is Jamutsuki, which means little bird that screams really loud and won't shut up. Well, I have no intention of shutting up because things are not right. The ecological grief is still happening to our people. You know, our sovereignty, our subsistence, our spirituality, our intrinsic ties to the land and the ocean are still being disrupted today. And so when I hear these stories of what's happening to other people in other lands, other places, all I can say is, you know, that we need to groom new leaders. We need to, stand up and fight against these things that continue to happen to us. You know, we need double-hull tankers. We need really highly advanced tugboats to, you know, help guide these big vessels into areas in communities where it's highly sensitive. So, you know, damages and catastrophes like the Exxon spill never happen again. And, you know, and I feel for the people, and what we've done on our end is we've done everything we possibly can to deal with the trauma and the colonization of our Native people by these Alaska Native corporations. You know, we've had to deal with the environmental destruction. And what we're trying to do is create regenerative economies that relocalize our lost economies, that bring our youth back to our communities. What we're doing here is we're starting the kelp and mariculture industry so we can, kelp can sequester carbon 5 to 20 times more than terrestrial forests. Bivalves, clams, oysters, mussels, can filter 40 to 60 gallons of water each per day. So they can clean out an entire bay in an afternoon. And so we have to, you know, do things that are going to help our environment to the best of our abilities. And we've got about 21 tribes across the state that are interested in this new kelp space. And they're interested for three purposes. Number one, for a restoration of our oceans. Number two, to grow and harvest a traditional food source to feed our people and that we can value add and sell our excess. And three, to build a regenerative economy is a green job where, you know, the Native peoples are getting paid to restore and mitigate the damages and build resiliency for the future because, you know, we have to find hope.
And, sure, we got to find ways to turn things around. And, you know, what you're making me think of, Dune, as you talk about this and remind us, you know, just because it's not making headlines doesn't mean it's still having effects. And how we use and put ourselves in motion to push back or to even fix things, especially our food systems and hearing the kind of work that's being done to counter some of this, I think that's an important element of what we're talking about today, too. And there is stuff being done. You know, when we talk about this grief being heavy, it's also led to action. It's also led to people reclaiming spaces or even just understanding how important the places and the land and the resources are to maybe even put people into action to protect things even more. And so that's a view into some of the things going on with Alaska. We have one more view to take before the hour is up. But if you want to share something, maybe you are an environmental advocate or someone working on how the climate is shifting, we want to hear from you too. How are you affected by seeing your land being affected, resources being affected, and how are you emotionally affected by the amount of work that needs to be done to restore the land? Want to hear from you? Dial now, 1-800-996-2848. Thank you for that, Dune. Also here, too, out of Missoula, Montana, is Dr. Roslyn Lapierre. She is an associate professor of environmental studies at the University of Montana, and she is an enrolled Blackfeet. She's enrolled Blackfeet, and she's also Métis. Our pleasure to have her here. Roslyn, welcome to Native America Calling. Thank you for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Tara. And thank Deborah, Dune, and Vi for really their good words and speaking to the truth of this particular topic. I agree, you know, ecological grief is a new term that has been in use for the last couple of years. But it's a new term that really helps explain, you know, real experiences, real pain, real despair, as we've just learned, especially both from Vi and Dune, what is happening up in the Arctic. And I think that as Dune was expressing at the end of his sharing his story, I think there's also a lot of optimism and a lot of opportunity with our young people and with especially our students who are really want to make change and who want to create a better world. As you know, Tara, today's Earth Day, and here in Missoula, Montana, at the university, we're celebrating Earth Day. All of our different student groups are out and today and sharing the projects they're working on. And so I think that there's really a this, although on the one hand, this process of grief is occurring within Indigenous communities, and I think that it really is a process that people need to work through, and which I strongly encourage communities to do, as we have done with other types of grief and trauma that our communities have worked with and worked through. I think that ecological grief is one that I encourage communities to add to the things that they discuss, the things they talk about. You know, if your community is going to have a gathering or a workshop, you know, start talking about the changes in the ecosystems and the grief that that does bring, but then also move sort of beyond that grief and move towards thinking about some of the solutions that we as Indigenous people can bring to the table.
And Roslyn, working with that next generation, the people who are going to be here, the people who are inheriting some of this as well, what is your, I guess, kind of your method in being able to make sure they understand exactly what has gone on and to show them a road that there are possibilities as opposed to, you know, just here's a dark cloud, here you go. You know, how do you move on from that? How do you inspire? How do you encourage? How do you nurture some of their own fight that they have? Go ahead.
Yeah, so I mean, I think that as Deborah had mentioned earlier, you know, I think that understanding our story, understanding our history is really key. I always share with the young people I work with and the students I work with, you know, that we've gone through this process of colonization, right? As part of colonization, there was land loss. There was a changeover of land ownership and how that land was valued. Then came sort of capitalism, right, which has already been shared with what has happened up in the Arctic that Vi and Dune have expressed. You know, with capitalism came a changeover of a Western viewpoint of looking at our land as a resource, right, as a place for extraction. And then after that, we're now sort of in this time period of climate change. And climate change is something that's impacting everybody. It's a global issue. And as Vi had mentioned, pollution with the POPs, the persistent organic pollutants that are in the Arctic, that that understanding that is very important to then being able to work towards solutions. And one of the ways that I share with students or young people in the community is there's two different ways to go down that road, right? One is through traditional knowledge and Indigenous knowledge and getting back in touch with learning about your own traditions and reconnecting to the land and the landscape, even if it is been even if there's desecration there. And then the other way is through Western education. I strongly encourage my students here, and especially my Indigenous students, to take all of those science classes, those Western science classes, you know, learn about environmental science, learn about hydrology, learn about how you can take that Western knowledge base, blend it with our Indigenous knowledge and our traditional knowledges, and be able to provide new solutions and new opportunities for our Indigenous communities. You know, our young people are the ones who are inheriting the world that we have today, which again has a long story. It has a long history, again, as Deborah has shared. But I think that there is still a lot of opportunity and optimism that we can see. And I see this on social media, right, every day. I see this with our young people who are just so interested and passionate about wanting to learn about our, again, our traditional knowledge and wanting to learn. You know, I'm an ethnobotanist, and I work a lot with native plants, and probably every day I am messaged or texted from young people who want to learn something and who are sharing this knowledge today in a modern, right, in a modern way, which is usually on social media. And so they are going to elders, they are going within the community, but they're also doing it in a modern context, right? And I think that those are, those new methods, those new ways of communicating with each other, addressing things, again, such as the ecological grief, but then moving more towards trying to come to solutions and moving beyond kind of the despair and the pain that they see within their communities, see their elders expressing. And so I think that by connecting again, kind of the Western academic sciences with Indigenous knowledge is a great place for young people to begin.
Especially our elders, and I know you've taken that road too, Roslyn, and we got to wrap things up here. Anything you want to leave us with? You got a minute.
Yes, I would just say again, learn that story about your own community, but also walk away from that story with strength and a sense of sort of love and protection that you can, as a young person, make a difference and take action to make a difference in the world that we live in. Take the grief, but move forward with that grief.
All right. Thank you for that. And we got to wrap things up here. But, you know, there is so much more to what we're talking about. Maybe it's going to inspire you to have a conversation with the people in your own circle thinking about this. Maybe that little reminder, you can call grandma, grandpa, auntie, uncle, and have that conversation. You know, we wish you best on that path too. But when we think of all of this and how it connects to who we are as Indigenous people, there's a lot there. And the continuation of this conversation, I know, happens once we sign off air. So really interested in your thoughts, too. If you want to continue it with us, you can always send us an email, comments@nativeamericacalling.com. And thank you to everybody we heard from in the hour, Vi Waihi, also Deborah, Dr. Deborah McGregor, and Dr. Roslyn Lapierre and Dune Lankard. Thank you all for being here with us. And tomorrow, when we sign back on air, we're going to jump into a discussion about the tradition of spear fishing. This is something your community does. We'll be ready for your stories and why this is important to your community. We hope you'll join us tomorrow. I'm Tara Gatewood.
So Support by the Sioux Trading Post, proud to provide traditional and contemporary American Indian craft supplies, from feathers, furs, and hides to conchos, fringe, shells, and beads, all available at SiouxTrading.com. Wopila. Support by Northern Arizona University. Explore a career in business, policy, environmental science, health management, and more. Their interdisciplinary and online degrees will meet your career needs where indigenous knowledge is applied. nau.edu/native.
Ah, Christspukni, Zieltzlu Chukelzem, Nan Christbiotin Sheet Luasalacht, Mkuxtil to Mariamistin Kulanui, Tommy Kuchanakes, Kulnacht Smeet, Kulkul Tausi, Skelly Such Mariam Yach Sachem, Chquiment Healthcare.gov, Uchwach Kulkul Tausent, 1-800-318-2596. Hietzma Meet and Centers Kul Medicare U Medicaid Services.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.